This is Frank Prattle. My name is Zephyr Throld. You're listening to KPOO 89.5 here in San Francisco. You're also listening to WPS1 Art Radio, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, a MoMA affiliate. You might also be listening to San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery website at www.sfacgallery.org. And of course, frankprattle.com. Today, excellent guests. This is going to blow the doors off. We have Lynn Marie Kirby, who is an artist here in San Francisco, but shows both nationally and internationally. Hi.
Hi. Nice to be here.
Lovely. And Chris Cobb, who is an artist who shows all over the damn place. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
You guys are about to go head-to-head talking about public versus private. Shall we begin with a brief introductory of who you guys are and what it is that you do? Maybe give a website if you have one or something like that. Lynn?
The website is pending, having taken down my former one. Yes, I am a media artist. I have been in San Francisco for many years, and I'm delighted to be in this Arts Commission show, along with several other people, where we're dealing with issues about reconciling America, and that's tied into so many of my interests about this topic that we're discussing, the public and private, which I actually think of not as a difference, but as a continuum, that there's sort of circles of observation, and how do we move between the spaces of the public and the private. I'll stop there, because okay. I could keep going, Chris. Oh,
don't worry, we'll get there. Have a sec. Chris, yourself?
Who am I? I'm an artist in San Francisco, and I also teach. From time to time, I teach drawing classes and some theory classes. And my background is I went to the San Francisco Art Institute, and I also went to UC Berkeley for my graduate degree. And I have I've lived in San Francisco about 12 years, and I participate in a lot of nonprofit organizations on a volunteer basis, and also have shown in a lot of them as well.
Yeah, I wanted to mention too that I teach at California College of the Arts, and also, like Chris, I'm engaged in the community in different ways.
Okay.
That might come up in our conversations.
Yeah, well, let's use that as a jumping off point here. Community. When people say community, about a million words and connotations flash through the mind. Some of them mm-hmm. good, some of them atrocious. And when you guys talk about a community in the art sense, what most often are you talking about?
Well, when I talk about community, I don't really think about community in the politically correct sense of community. I think because I think in art, community is more about interacting with the public. When you're an artist, you're essentially a performer, and you have an audience. And there's a call and response that's kind of like music in the most ideal circumstance, where the artist puts forth something and public responds to it, and then dialogue is generated from that. So in that sense, I think of community.
Community, there are many different communities, and I feel that I'm engaged in many communities, one of which is the community of my son's school right now, which is what the project at Arts Commission Gallery is about. I'm working with the boys from my son's class, and that becomes a whole new community, which then starts to speak to the art community, which is manifested here in this gallery, the Arts Commission Gallery. So this idea of community for me is a very mobile lens through which any project that I work on sort of introduces me to another community. And I agree with Chris, I think that making art is, I make something and I put it out, and then the viewer, the participant, makes half of the work, actually. They come and they bring their experience to what I put forward, and then we're in conversation.
Right.
So that creates another kind of community.
Right. What, as far as, you know, the negative connotations of community, you have many people who are plain snobby about art. You know, I'm going to say it as it is, that there are rich people who consider art to be something that you purchase at a gallery and you hang on your wall, and anything that has to do with masses of people filming them or talking to them is BS, to be frank. And what are your guys' feelings about that?
Do you mean like video art?
video art, or dealing, you know, with more community-oriented things where you're
dealing with people. How some people think that conceptual art is like all bullshit or something. I'd say this. There's a lot of art education that probably should have taken place in elementary and high school, and part of the biggest issue maybe in San Francisco in terms of community and perception of community is that when art involves the community in projects, it's seen as some kind of weird left-wing offshoot of welfare or Medicare, or, you know,
right,
like help
right.
the homeless, take their picture, whatever, you know, and make them, you know, in reality, it's more about an artist reinterpreting ideas, you know, of like how society should be. You know, the artist does that ideally, you know, takes an issue or an idea and reexamines it. And so through exhibitions, they can kind of show where they agree or disagree. And then, you know, that's like part of social change. It's not necessarily, you know, the kind of multicultural where we're all the same. And, you know, we're doing this art as a kind of like social work. You know, I think that is kind of where a lot of that attitude got originated from.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that that's only one part of the spectrum, this sort of social work, relational aesthetics attitude towards art. And I think that one can work anywhere along the spectrum. I mean, if people want to paint paintings that are sold to collectors who want to spend lots of money, that's fine. If people want to work with you know, underserved communities and do projects, that's fine. I mean, I think that there's many ways that one can define art making, and I think that's what Chris is talking about too, is that how do we broaden our understanding of what art is rather than shut it down by judging one as less than another.
Or, I mean, for instance, you know, radio projects that people call art.
Art. I don't know if this is art yet. Maybe we could make it art.
So tell us a little bit more, Lynn, about your project that's here at the San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery.
It was inspired. I've worked often with the people in my surroundings, my family, and I'm very interested in the idea that any particular project is a convergence of biography, history, and culture. And that's when you gave us this topic of the public and the private, I was thinking about how really that's what the public and the private is this convergence of these three things. And I have been watching our son grow up, and now he's 11, and I realize that we now live in a culture where these transitions are no longer marked. So in former societies, there would have been a puberty ritual of some kind, and we would have understood, children would have understood that they had moved into this other phase of their lives. Just as when people get married, they understand they've moved from being I to we, and I think that's a huge struggle for us in the culture to understand these kinds of transitional modes. And I was interested in marking that and looking at that, because I think that it's very confusing now for both boys and girls. How do boys become men, you know, and how do girls become women? And I think the messages from what we see around us are confusing, and I wanted to honor these boys as they went through this process of becoming men. So I began working with the boys at my son's school, and in the gallery are the first two, and I'm hoping to finish working with all 34 boys, and I asked them questions based on Truffaut's film 400 Blows, which is a fabulous film about boys and this sort of transitional period. And also I was inspired by Andy Warhol's Screen Test, where he asked people to just look in time at the camera. And so I asked the boys to stand in front of the camera and just look at the camera. And it's a portrait in time of these boys at this particular moment in time. And I think there are questions about when, I asked them, when do they think boys become men? And their answers are really extraordinary,
what,
I think.
Tell us.
One boy thinks that it's when you learn to drive. And so I think, you know, that is something that he gets from the culture. When you learn to drive, you're then, you know, you're entitled to, you know, be out in the culture in a way that you're not.
I was definitely, when drugs, first using drugs. Then
and was that?
Yeah. They're like, if you can smoke weed, you're an adult.
Then you're an adult, you know. So...
keep going. Or I'm sorry, I'm lost.
No,
I got you derailed.
Yeah, you derailed me. I'll get back on. Oh, so but what I also did for this particular installation is that I asked the boys to write about war, because this gallery is in the War Memorial Opera House and the Veterans Building, and so I asked them to write a little paragraph about war. And I think it's really extraordinary to see how thoughtful and how much they actually think about this. Half their lives, their country has been at war. And so, you know, they think about it not only in terms of globally, but in terms of what that means for them as young men, and in relation to things like video games. So the project is both, for me, working with these boys, honoring them, talking about culture, and also then talking about this sort of biographical moment in time, this transition from boyhood to manhood.
Right. Well, and Chris, in your own estimation, I mean, when you were coming through, you know, coming up through puberty, what did you consider to be the moment where you were, you know, an adult?
When I became a man.
If you want to say that.
That's a very interesting question. When did I become a man? Well, I'd have to say there's this one camping trip in Northern California when I had a catharsis, you could call it. I went out with a friend of mine. We were both 15 years old, and we convinced our parents' hippie friends to let us go. And they drove us up to Mount Shasta and let us camp for 2 weeks on our own. And when you're 15 years old, you know.
Big deal.
You think, well, you know, it'd be okay for him to leave us out in the middle of the woods for 2 weeks with nothing except what we thought we should bring. So a lot of really upsetting things happened in that camping trip.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Do tell.
But you survived, right?
Yeah, it's
you came
really,
out the other end, a man.
Well, it's. I think a lot of children should go into the woods and the mountains when they're little, because I think it connects them to the earth a lot more.
I think it's great. I think it's fantastic.
And when you're, and especially if you're, you know, supposed to kind of become a full adult, you know, you kind of benefit a lot from the direct experiences, mm-hmm. you know, like with nature, you know, and survival and things like that. I learned how to light a fire in the rain during a rainstorm. But not because I was smart, it was because I was desperate and I was soaking wet.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think these kinds of experiences are important. How do they form us? How do you know that you can live on your own? Maybe that's really the transitional thing.
Right. A lot of it, becoming an adult is partly about self-reliance. But I mean, like, bring it back to art. I mean, like, if you're an artist, I think that the more direct experiences with life you have, the better your art is probably going to be. Because I think a lot of times art, especially public art, suffers from a lack of connection to the audience that's being served, you know, because if it's too top heavy on the side of the artist and the artist's experience, then I think that there can be a disconnect, you know, like, I mean.
What about the idea that the more particular the experience, the more it's possible that other people can then bring their own experience to it?
Well, I mean, that's a philosophical issue. I mean, it's also kind of utopian thinking that, like, you know, if my, you know, hair gets clogged in the drain and I have to, like, clean it out, you know, and I make art about that, other people will be like, yeah, me too, you know. But, like, you know what I mean? But, like, a lot of people, they might not experience that, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, like, if you're, like...
So do you think there's certain topics or subjects that are available?
They have a broader kind of cultural resonance. Yeah, sure. I mean, mm-hmm. but again, it's like a conversation. I mean, like a performer. I went to a Neil Diamond concert once.
Really?
Because I was like, yeah, I was fascinated by his.
His stuff.
His stuff, right? His mojo. Yeah, because people worshipped him. You know, they worshipped him like a god. You know, and I didn't understand that. You know, I never really cared for his music, but some friends of mine and I went to kind of, you know, try to get it, you know, or whatever. And so it was interesting to watch. You know, he had this like charisma. It's like a preacher. You know,
my grandmother went to the grave loving him.
Electrical, magical. Like energy, I hate to sound all hippie, but he had this energy he projected outwards and people just absorbed it. It was pretty remarkable. Okay. And I thought, you know, that's kind of an art, you know, practice too, is that being able to reach out, you know, through whatever essential stuff you have. But see, he calls himself, I saw an interview with him, and he said he wasn't a musician. He was an entertainer. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was a very important distinction.
But that's perceptive on his part, wasn't it?
It is, self-awareness. Yeah. Well, first order experiences.
So similar to this line of thinking in dealing with public versus private, one of my favorite projects that you have done, Chris, is the There's Nothing Wrong in This Whole Wide World, mm-hmm. done at Adobe Books here in San Francisco a while ago. Maybe would you care to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I might talk about that in the context of some other projects, too, if that's okay. I like the idea that you can take an art approach to different environments and change the perception of an environment. And it might be a little bit didactic or formal, but with that particular bookstore, I befriended the owner, and over a year I convinced him to allow me to take over his business for a few weeks. And he allowed me to take about 30,000 of his books, and with a group of volunteers, we rearranged the books so that they were all organized by the color and a kind of color spectrum. But part of that, too, is that the kind of art education I had kind of emphasized ideas over making things. And I realized that in retrospect that I didn't really make anything with that installation. And then it that caused me to realize then that a lot of artists come from this kind of education where ideas are emphasized over, technique or manufacturing things. And I could see that, maybe in a lot of ways, the Bay Area kind of celebrates ideas over, crafted objects. And you can kind of see that as a hallmark of a lot of stuff that comes from here. Even painting here tends to be more conceptually based. Photography, like Todd Heido or Richard Mizrach or Susanna Hayes, they emphasize the absence of things or the unknown rather than what's known.
Isn't that a kind of exciting way to look at things, that you think of it conceptually, so that that framing really becomes what art making is about, and it's framing. I mean, I'm really interested in this question of framing things that might not be visible or that are part of a layer of narrative and history that we might not see, and so we reframe it so that we can look at it again. And the idea of materials then becomes something very different. It, rather than, say, the actual paint itself, it's also this idea of how we organize what we look through. So, I did a project in the 90s where it was called Framing Sound, where I put frames around the city of San Francisco that framed former immigrant sites. And Angel Island was one of them. The INS building was one of them. Mount Tamalpais was one of them because, of course, it had been a Native American sacred site. And really, it was just a frame through which people would then look and see that. And I put little titles on the bottom that said some things like Angel Island echoes, no, sounds of ships passing. So you would look at Angel Island again, or look at the INS building again. And it was very interesting because I went down to document at Fisherman's Wharf. The one for Angel Island was down at Fisherman's Wharf, which is a real tourist place. And people were getting their pictures taken inside the frames. They were looking. And it was, what was great, though, is that people were thinking about history and art in a different way.
But you had literal physical frames.
I had a physical frame.
Picture frames.
It was built out of steel and rusted steel, so it looked like gilt, So it was a literal framing. But I think what we're doing is framing all the time. These were very literal because they were actually up on the sidewalk. But
there's a book, I don't remember who it's by, but he was a New York dealer who helped promote a lot of conceptual art in the late 60s and early 70s. I wish I could remember who it was. But he wrote a book, and I read through it briefly, and he talked about rhetorical framing and language and linguistics. And I think he made a lot of money by selling ideas, as art. And he stepped away from the physical and talked more about, like, in the sense of, like, advertising or marketing, mm-hmm. How ideas, penetrate pubic art, penetrate into culture deeply, and it's really true. Ideas go much further, much deeper, much faster, much harder than anything else in any field, like politics, in academia. Like, an idea is like this kind of evolutionary thing, like, catches fire, people talk about it, it's the essence of viral marketing, and ideas are what drive, economies. And
I think it's always been ideas that have driven art. I think even David, was painting, it was about the ideas. The ideas were about the materials and how we looked and the three-point perspective. So I think art has always been driven by these ideas. I think there was a while, though, that people sort of forgot that it was driven by ideas and thought, oh, it's materials or, but I can't think of a time that art wasn't driven by conceptual ideas. I think what's happened is since the 60s and 70s that the conceptual has moved to the very front of the lens, so to speak, through which we look, and I think it moves forward and backwards where it is in relation to materials.
Well, I mean, I might take issue with something that, Chris, that you said earlier about this town being known primarily for conceptual art, and say that probably what is internationally known right now about San Francisco is the Mission School of painters, those being, Barry McGee and Chris Johansson, and those, not arguing that they are, less conceptually based, but I would say, perhaps not as much as, what you guys are talking about, that they're very craft-based. It's very much about putting the paint on the wall. Sometimes the wall can't be sold, just putting it on the street and things like that.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, but I mean, if you talk to Chris Johansson, he'd be like, yeah, man, I just do this. I like it, man. And like when you look at his paintings, people don't go, wow, he paints like Rembrandt. His paintings are so good. They're not getting off on how detailed and realistic and trippy his like technique is. They're getting off on the fact that he has really interesting, quirky ideas, and he uses like Barry McGee or like Robert Crumb. Like if Robert Crumb just drew pictures and didn't have text, then wouldn't be the same. But Chris, makes like narratives through thought balloons, and that's the stuff that really ties his work together. He uses like a really bare, almost not even like, I mean, very childlike kind of scrawl in his paintings, but like that's not enough, the strength of, well, I think a lot of his work is that he, communicates to the viewer about things, and like even in his sculptures, they're like funny and witty and humorous. There's one that's like a I don't know, do you know this video installation called Drum Circle?
Yeah.
Where it's like a circle of TVs and it's all these like dudes like drumming. It's kind of ridiculous. And like if you just look at it, it's kind of stupid. If you bought like one, TV with someone drumming, that wouldn't be funny. But when you put it all together, so I mean,
It's also speaking about the sort of cultural thing of the men banging on drums. I think it was Robert Bly, was that who it was, who was trying to get men to go out into the country and bang on drums? So it
Bad
is
idea.
Conceptual
Bad
in that
idea.
Way. It's talking about these kinds of undercurrents of cultural movements. And the craft thing comes from the arts and crafts movement that from Northern California with Maybeck, the architect, and which people are having problem with because sometimes they think that crafts is macrame, but craft isn't. Craft comes from the Bauhaus and this idea of living in a circular kind of way where how you make and how you are interrelated.
Well, why did CCA have to drop that craft out of their name then?
Well,
give context to what you're talking about, that one of the major art schools here in San Francisco is called California College of the Arts. And crafts.
That's where she works.
It used to be crafts.
But they felt the need that crafts were not necessary any longer.
And I think that's because people do not have a historical memory. They don't realize that it was tied to the arts and crafts movement. Rather, the memory goes to the 60s where they thought crafts was macrame. And so I think that there's crafts is a bigger picture. And I think sometimes that's where we confuse.
If someone were to describe your own art as craft, what would you say? After you slap them.
I have nothing against craft. I mean, we need to work with materials to make things, even if we don't know how to work with the materials and we hire somebody to work with materials. I think the materials are the lens through which we work. And for example, I work with media technology in this project, and it's very important to me that people, I mean, you get another layer if you understand that it's film transferred to video, because then you understand that film is a particular medium that has a particular history that came out of the mechanical age, and now we're looking at it through a scrim of digital video, which is in the digital age. So we see these meetings of histories. If one sees it, one gets something else. If one doesn't see it, then one doesn't get that. And I think that that's the spectrum of viewers. Some people will get that, some people won't. But it, we use technology always, and that technology, whether it's a pen or paint, has a history. And I think that's a craft idea.
I had a, not to talk too much about myself, but I had a girlfriend once who had never seen, she'd probably seen it before, but I mean, it never actually touched.
A what?
A real typewriter, you know, and I had it like in the corner of my room, and she was like, oh my God, that's like an old typewriter. How does it work? You know, and I was like, well, you know, you just take this piece of paper and you put it here and you roll it up in there and then you, and she was like, oh my God. And she just started typing away. And she like had the greatest time, you know, and I was like, you know, like I grew up around typewriters and it wasn't that crazy to me to have one around. But to her, it was like the most amazing thing. But I mean, in terms of what you're saying, you know, about appreciating the nuance of film transferred to video, true, you know, if you're like a pure filmmaker, you know, then that is a big deal. But if you're like somebody who's younger, you know, who's never even seen a film projected before, then they totally don't connect with issue, you know.
Yeah, I understand that people don't get it, but that doesn't mean that it's not present and part of our history. And that's,
true.
I guess, what
yeah.
I'm trying to talk about. And as, you know, part of the pleasures of, one of the pleasures of life is understanding the systems involved in things. And so for me, that's really important if it's on a conceptual level or a mechanical level. I mean mechanical in terms of how things work as larger systems. So the materials that one uses. I mean, in the show, there's a painter who, Brendan Lott, who sends images taken from the net to China and has master painters paint these. And I think it's really important to, in understanding the work, to understand this whole system, you know, that it's painted by people who are incredible painters and they work carefully with the hands and so on, but it's based on an image that comes from the internet. And so there's this whole cycle of production, of global production and seeing. And sometimes we can see it and sometimes we don't. I'm always really excited when I see something that I hadn't understood before. I understand a system as a bigger system. I mean, it's really hard because life is so sophisticated now and so much of what we work with is kind of a black box. I mean, I don't understand the total workings of the computers that I use, you know, but if I did, that would be another way of understanding the world. Yeah.
And, you know, many people would argue that that's the artist's job, is to kind of, you know, make up fictional ideas of connections between things that happen in the world. And
fiction is one of the tools, right?
Yeah.
It can be reality, it can be fiction, it can be any combination of the two.
Right. Yeah. One question that I have for both of you guys, and this is coming, you know, strictly from somebody who's been to a lot of art exhibits and you know, left many times with a headache or left, you know, annoyed. Is why? What is driving both of your practices? What do you hope to transmit to the masses that wasn't there before or that possibly was there that you're, you know, enriching or something? Why?
I'm interested in creating possibilities for viewers to have experiences to reflect on a particular subject, and that the work is only, what I do is only half of it. What the viewer brings is the other half, and that I want to create a possibility to have a moment of reflection, a moment of meditation, a moment of thought. Our lives are really, really busy. When someone takes the time to go to a gallery, there's an opportunity to sort of step inside at some point. I hope it would be inside. Meditate on something that I think is interesting. I mean, sometimes I think about it and think, well, you know, that's pretty selfish of you. You want people to come and meditate on a subject that you think is important. But I try to think that it's something that I share with other people, that I think is important that we all, this is what I was talking about a little earlier, that if you choose, one chooses something that potentially is out in the zeitgeist in some way or something that we all experience, then there's an opportunity for us to communicate as people.
Why?
What drives my practice? I would say there's a belief, I guess. I have a philosophical belief that is similar to this religion called animism, which I just recently discovered what animism actually is defined as. Animism, which like primitive tribes tend to, you know, adopt as their way of belief, is that they, an animist sees like a soul force in objects, you know. So like a cup has cupness, and a pen has penness, and a table has tableness. What's the essential nature of a table, and that sort of thing, which when I realized that was the definition of animism, then I realized that's a lot of like what I understood to be like sculptural principles and art principles. You know, if you're making something, then it should make sense, you know, and be congruent. So I guess for me, I like to tell those kinds of stories, you know, about whatever I'm working with, or reveal a story. There's like the last exhibition I was in was at a small San Francisco abandoned marketplace called Hayes Valley Market. And it was a group show with two filmmakers, actually, Larry Jordan and Nathaniel Dorsky. Mm-hmm. And they both insisted on showing 16 millimeter film, not video, not DVD. I was given any option as to what I wanted to show in this space. And it's a really large kind of, you know, former supermarket. And I wanted to do something that kind of involved the community and kind of tell the story a little bit about the neighborhood. And so I went out and looked at what was available to me, you know, in terms of, you know, what I'd want to work with. And since, you know, through a process of elimination, I decided I just wanted to work with colors. So I went up to all of the buildings in the neighborhood, and I took like little color samples, and then I just made a grid of different colors of all the buildings in the neighborhood. And even though on one level it's like it was like this abstract kind of geometrical, you know, painting on these windows, on another level it was also, you know, relating to the neighborhood. So, you know, it had two layers or three layers of kind of ideas behind it. So it kind of told the story of a neighborhood, but it made, you know, reference to what was outside of itself, you know. And it wasn't just a dead, you know, thing. It was actually, I mean, I felt it was living, you know, kind of existing with the neighborhood. And it also was only there for the time of the show. Then we scraped it off with spatulas.
It's great to hear you talk about your practice, because I realize in talking with you that we share a lot of interests, and I have been doing this series called the Latent Light Excavations, where I actually take film and expose it to the light of sites that I think are interesting or contested in some way. And I was reminded when you talked about that show of a show that I had in Nevada. I was asked to do a show at the University of Nevada.
It wasn't the exact same thing, was it?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't exactly the same, but it was based on the same idea of being asked to come to a place. And I didn't want to just import my work to the place and hang it up in the gallery. I mean, I try to be sensitive to the site. What's happening there? What's happening to the site? What's the history of that place in some way? And so whenever I'm invited to do a show, I really try to tie it to what's there. You know, it seems to make sense to me. And in Nevada, I started, I went up for a visit because it's not too far away, did a family road trip, you know. And what I realized is that so many people have left California and moved to Nevada because of
gambling and hookers.
Gambling and also, you know, property and taxes. But I started thinking of the history of Nevada, and one of the things was that Reno was the site of instant American divorce for many years. You know, people would go live for a few months in Reno, and right around the time that I was asked to do this show was the time that gay marriage was so contested. And so I learned that Nevada was in the process of being one of the first four states to come out with an anti-gay marriage legislation. And so I thought, well, that's very interesting. That's the site that's related to this. So I went, I decided I would expose film to the light of a wedding chapel because that's such a contested site. And I chose sites that were related to Reno in that way. I went to Pyramid Lake Paiute Reservation because that's such a contested site. That, I mean, historically, our relationship with Native Americans, and also because of water shortages in Nevada, they have this big lake. And so it was interesting to then take these exposures. I take the film and expose it to the light of the site. And the idea that was really inspired by things like Stonehenge and where the light is always the same at a particular time of year, but it's in the way that you were talking about, this kind of animism where but light also is like that. Light captures across time. And then I would take that film, transfer to video, and bring it back into the gallery so that it related to that place, you know? And so I was thinking that we share these similar interests of being related in different ways, but being related, relating the work to a site, that it comes out of a conversation.
Yours sounds really French to me.
Well, you know, I lived in Paris for many years.
There you go.
How did you know that?
No, I can tell. I can smell this stuff a mile away. Let me tell you. I spent some time in Paris.
And I saw this
again and again and again. And it's just incredible how long that stuff lingers, you know? Do you know what I'm talking about, Zachary?
I haven't the foggiest, but it's so nice to say. What is French?
What is French?
What is French? Well, to me, coming from California, what French appears to be is a type of work. I mean, it's not critical.
That's okay. I don't mind if it's critical.
No, because it's a style. It's a stylistic thing. I mean, like, you know, Annette Messager and, like, Christian Boltanski do it too, you know. So they're good artists. You know, I'd say the same thing about them. And, you know.
But I think of myself as an
Pierre Bourdieu, you know, writes about it. It's cool,
Pierre,
you know. The thing I perceive is that there's a very dedicated interest in telling a lot of stories through art, you know, mm-hmm. as opposed to one story.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's kind of the opposite of pop art, you know. It's mm-hmm. like the pop art, but like in reverse, mm-hmm. you know, instead of being like, here's the most surface element that I want to kind of celebrate, you know, instead it's like, here are all these different ideas and how they all connect, and then I'm going to put them all together into this thing. And in I think in France and probably in Europe in general, there's more art education, and so when people experience art like that, they're very interested in a lot of texts. They're like with Ho Hon Ryu, he's all, you know, he writes all the time. He spent a part of his life in France. He speaks French. You know, a lot of his, you know, curatorial practice is based around lots of text, lots of explaining, and there's a lot of stuff in it because also in Europe, like I said, there's an art audience that's more mm-hmm. accustomed to that, and they're, you know, they hang out in art galleries and they like want to know what's going on, you know, and their catalogs are really thick, and like when you go to a French art show, there's all this text all over the wall, and it's remarkable. I saw an art poster one time, like when I was in Paris, and it was like this giant fold-out poster, and I thought, wow, I get this free cool art poster. It was all text except for this one little image of whatever the, you know, like painting was at the show, and it was like incredible. I was like, whoa, this is all text. And I was like trying to read it, and I was like, wow, this is, but they get into all the philosophy and they get into all the like connections between things, you know, which Americans have very short attention spans. So, you know, it's one of the big differences between like a Joseph Beuys and like a Andy Warhol, you know.
Well, I think Andy Warhol actually did just that. The histories of his pieces were fantastic. The religious paintings, for example, that I can't remember now, The Last Supper, that has these signs. I think there's GE. Anybody can help me here, do you remember? And what's amazing is that it's all about the history of those companies that then tell the history of the Last Supper through the logos. So I think that a lot of artists, I understand what you're saying about this sort of, but I think I'm not convinced that there isn't that same sort of historical interest in the States. I think we say that often because it's easy to say, especially in California, oh, we're less interested in history because it's so fresh and so young. But I mean, we also have deep geological history on our side, you know,
I'm sorry to interrupt. Has anyone ever accused you of being a European artist before?
George Kuchar, when I was a graduate student George at the Art Institute, said to me, Lynn, your work is so European.
There you go.
But George, you know, George, we love George.
Speaking of other places as well, what shows do you guys have coming up? Lynn, yourself, you have something?
In a few weeks, I'm going to be in a show of California video art at the Getty that I'm
in
quite
Los
excited
Angeles.
In Los Angeles. Yeah.
Okay. And then, Chris, yourself?
I'm going to go on a sabbatical from San Francisco and work on a three-story Solowit exhibition that's going to last for 25 years at Mass MoCA in Massachusetts. And I'm going to be involved in that, and then I might curate.
25 years?
Yeah, right before Solowit died, he made a contract with Mass MoCA to take over a factory building and renovate it, so 93 of his wall drawings and paintings will be installed. There might be some sculpture, but I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. There's a big team, mostly from the East Coast, that's there, but I got invited to be on the project. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I might have something going on in Chelsea, but I'm not sure yet.
Sounds good.
I'd like to ask you a question because I was thinking about the work that you had done with, say, mashed potatoes and carving little statues, I guess, into glue sticks. And I wanted to ask you a bit about something that's been of interest to me, and which is this idea of looking and seeing what's involved in daily kinds of objects and dailiness. And could you talk a bit about that? Because that's something that's been very important to me, this idea of paying attention to what's happening, small things that are happening. It seems like you do that. And I wonder why do you put that as, do you consider that an American practice as in contrast to, I'm just trying to understand how you, because I don't think of these divided up that way. I think this notion of attention is something that one does as an artist. And so anyway, I sort of throw that back to you about this idea of looking and dailiness and how dailiness relates to these ideas of the public and the private.
Okay. Well, there's this book by Susan Stewart called On Longing.
I love that book.
Narratives of the miniature, the gigantic, the souvenir, and something like that. And it's a very important book because it talks about time and scale. It talks about how time changes when you have a very small thing or a very large thing. And you talk of like nanotechnology, like the time of a cell, you know, in your body, like a skin cell, the time it lives and dies compared to like a star, you know, like when it lives and dies, totally different time scales, but, you know, related to their physical size. So time and things like that, you know, affect scale. So also like Louise Bourgeois, you know, recently they installed a giant metal spider of hers on the Embarcadero, and I went to look at it, and out there, you know, like, I mean, it's a spider, you know, I mean, a lot of people might go, well, good job, Louise. You made a spider, and it's big, you know? So what, you know? I could understand that kind of attitude because right next to it is a giant Claes Oldenburg, like, bow and arrow. It's like, hey, right next to the giant spider is a giant bow and arrow, you know? Whoa, you know? And it's like, wow, that was hard to make, you know? But, like, the reason why they're actually, like, interesting art objects is because of those issues of time and scale, because the time of the bow and arrow changes, you know, into this like celestial time, you know, and the giant spider is big enough to, like, if it was real, to eat like a cow, you know, or a couple of cows. And so it's much more dangerous and ominous, and it summons up all these issues that aren't present when the spider is only like in, mm-hmm. you know, half an inch, you know, around. So, I mean, I think about stuff like that, you know, mm-hmm. but I think, I mean, also, I mean, you know, Renee Pritikin, who used to be the curator, the head curator at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, who's now at the Nelson Gallery at UC Davis, like, he came to the San Francisco Art Institute when I was a student, and he gave a talk, and he blew everybody away, because when he started talking, he said that, that when you graduate from art school, the biggest problem you're going to have isn't people stopping you from what you want to do, but that that fundamentally that nobody's ever going to care. And he said, nobody cares what you do. You know, you have to make them care. And if you can't make them care, they won't care. And I thought, whoa, you know, oh, that can't be right. And then sure enough, you know.
Sure enough, you know.
And it's so true. Because also, not to be all literary, but, you know, Sylvia Plath also wrote in her journals about caring and how she felt that before she could move other people, she had to move herself. You know, and I thought that was also like kind of the same sentiment that Rennie was expressing, that a lot of the job that you do as an artist is like inside you, you know, that you find something that's really important or interesting to you. And if you find something that's really interesting, you know, in general, then instead of like, oh, I'm just doing this because I'm having a good time and I'm making patty cake and I'll make an art about patty cake, you know, or, you know, if you're like, oh, I like to, you know, sweep a lot, I'll make an art about brooms, you know. I mean, like, if it's like that, if you really care about brooms or whatever, maybe you make this gigantic, really cool broom sculpture or whatever. But, like, a lot of people probably don't care about brooms, and so they'll be like, well, but that person really likes to sweep, you know, that's cool, but, like, I'm not into sweeping, so, you know, I'm going to go to Brendan Lott's paintings instead.
But I think it's not, to me, it's not just the subject, it's how we deal with the subject. So I want to come back to that, because I actually don't think there are any subjects that are off bounds, and that I think if you want to make a piece about sweeping, then how do we sweep? How are we engaged in the activity of sweeping? And that could be a very fascinating piece. In fact, I have made a piece about sweeping.
Oh God, I'm totally
no.
I'm
but
just drunk.
I know, but I want to tell you, because I swept my floor every day for a year, and I photographed it, and I made it into this idea of how could I be present on an for an activity. We talk about domestic and public or private and public.
Right,
on an
right.
activity that I had to do. I had a young child. Every day I had to sweep up the breadcrumbs after breakfast, and I thought, well, I could either be doing that and not making art, or I could make, you know, I could put my camera down on the floor.
Kids make a lot of mess.
But it was the idea of being present with the camera, and how could I look at sweeping as something bigger than sweeping, that sweeping could begin to speak about focus and concentration, everything that you're talking about from the On Longing book, that this little tiny activity can make us think about other kinds of things. So I mean, earlier we were talking about the hair in the drain. I mean, the hair in the drain could be fascinating if it's how it's done. I really think, I'd like to think all subjects are possible and embraceable. Some are easier, though. At that, I do agree.
Well, I think that's a perfect place to leave it. Excellent job, you guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Frank Prattle. My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to KPOO 89.5 FM here in San Francisco. You're also listening to WPS1 Art Radio, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, a MoMA affiliate. You might also be listening to San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery website at sfacgallery.org, or, of course, at frankprattle.com. Today, my special guests, all over the place, I love you both, have been Chris Cobb, who's an artist here in San Francisco, and Lynn Marie Kirby as well, an artist. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.